Given the fact that Pennsylvania has one of the highest incarceration rates in the country and some of the toughest discovery rules for defense attorneys, it's pretty remarkable that it wasn't until 2009 that an Innocence Project was established in the state. Originally housed at Temple University, it was staffed by a small team that was assisted by students from Temple Law School and Villanova University School of Law. Over the past 8 years, the Pennsylvania Innocence Project has multiplied and grown, and now has programs at Thomas R. Klein Drexel School of Law, the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Rutgers University Law School, and Penn State School of Law. And in 2016, they opened offices in Pittsburgh, housed by Duquesne University Law School. The first time that I met the folks from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project was last year. I shared a panel with the very dynamic, charismatic Marissa Bluestein, who was at that time the legal director of the Innocence Project. After I gave my remarks, I listened to her talk about some of the pressing cases that they were dealing with. One of them stunned me and haunted me for weeks after I left that event. So later that year, as Susan, Colin, and I were exploring new possible wrongful conviction cases to cover this year, I remembered the case that Marissa spoke about. It was about a young man named Sean Thomas.
My name is Marissa Bluestein. I am now the executive director for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project as of about 3 weeks ago. Before that, I was the legal director and had been since the project started in April 2009. And I have been Sean Thomas's attorney almost that entire time.
Since 2009?
Yes.
The Pennsylvania Innocence Project isn't like many others that only deal with cases that involve DNA evidence.
I wish we had DNA on our case. I mean, I kind of tease those guys because for me, DNA is easy.
Right.
Right. It's there, it's not. If it's there, you test it. It's him or it's not. And that's pretty much it. Right. For our cases, we're the ones who are knocking on doors at 3rd and Indiana, the heart of the Badlands in Philadelphia, saying, were you around 20 years when Country got shot? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what happened? Right. So we're usually talking about witnesses who saw what happened, know what happened, have knowledge of what happened, know about who did it.
Right.
All that and trying to put those pieces together 5, 10, 15, 20 years after it happened. And that's not easy stuff to do.
It's not easy stuff to do, but it didn't deter this Innocence Project. And Sean Thomas is certainly very thankful for that.
He was one of the first people who, when I started the organization in April 2009, when we first opened the doors, we had about 300 letters already waiting for us. I mean, the news had traveled fast. And so Sean's letter, I know we got in 2009. I can't recall when exactly. But around the time we opened, an attorney named Jim Pogorski had called me and said, I'd love to volunteer with you guys. And it turns out that the reason he wanted to volunteer with us is because he had been a law enforcement officer for 25 years in Philadelphia and had seen his own cases come up where somebody, he worked on narcotics and he would work with somebody and they would confess to a murder or confess to a crime. He would call down to homicide and get, no, we're good.
We got our guy.
Don't worry your pretty little head about it. And Jim, understandably, was kind of upset by that. So he knew from his own experience that we were locking up people who committed no crime. And so he volunteered with us. So I would give him a bunch of cases to review, and he kind of went through probably about five or six. And then he got to Sean's to review for me. And it was probably the letter, the Superior Court opinion, the briefs. And he came, I'll never forget this, he came into my office, and he said, Marissa, this one, there's something about this one, I think he may be innocent. I said, well, Jim, you're a lawyer. What are you going to do? And he says, I guess I have a new client. I said, I think you do. And so, and that's kind of how it started. The case just so resonated with Jim's experience as a law enforcement officer that everything Sean was saying was true or could be true. Mm-hmm. And if what he said was true, then a gross miscarriage of justice had occurred. Because not only was he not at the crime, Sean's alibi is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania itself. Because he was either in the custody of the Philadelphia Police Department or in standing in front of a magistrate judge in a juvenile court. This isn't baby mama, right? This isn't mom or dad who love you might lie. This is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And how that could have gone unnoticed and not acted upon for 20 years was astonishing to us.
It's crazy.
The case was turned over to Jim Figorski, who you've heard from on the past two episodes. Now, what you might not have known, although we did discuss it just a bit on last week's addendum until now, was what Marissa just said, that Jim is an ex-Philadelphia cop, and that in his career, he repeatedly witnessed the police department ignore evidence that they had arrested and charged an innocent person.
I was a Philadelphia policeman for 25 years, 1981 to 2006. I was assigned to two different districts, and then for 20 of those years, I was in a narcotics unit. I was also in, you know, for a short time in the intelligence unit and DEA task force. When I retired, I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office for 6 months as a law clerk, and then I came here to Deckard. When I was in the police department, I saw some, you know, well, there were certain murder convictions that I had my doubts about. And they were based, as I've told Marissa and Sean about many times, they were based upon certain things that happened when I was in the intelligence unit and DEA task force. When I was in the intelligence unit, we were mandated to do interviews with everyone in the city who was arrested. It was a really good idea, and we asked them a certain series of pre-formatted questions. And one of the questions that our people were supposed to ask was, what do you know about murders? And on several occasions, we got information that the people who had been convicted didn't do it. And it was pretty good information by, you know, guys who said that they were there and witnessed it. And we turned it over to homicide, and nothing ever happened. Same thing happened when I was in DEA task force. I went there and we did proffers in the federal system where people would come forward and they were mandated to tell everything they knew because they wanted to cooperate. And one of my standard questions that I had our people ask was, what do you know about murders? And there were times when we got the same answers. And many of those murders were from the same period of time, which was the late 80s to the early 90s. And I began to suspect that there might be problems with some of those convictions from that time period. And when I would ask homicide what happened with these murders, I would inevitably get the answer, you know, they would say, you know, something along the lines of, you know, trust me, he's guilty. And at first I would accept that answer because these were the guys who did this for a living. But after a while I started to question, how do they know he's guilty if I'm telling them that there's a person who said it didn't happen that way and he was there? And it was, you know, some of these murder convictions were based on nothing more than a snitch or a jailhouse snitch or something like that. And I thought that the evidence that I was bringing in, which was an eyewitness, was much more powerful than that, but they didn't want to hear it.
There's no doubt there was an uptick in the late 80s and early 90s in wrongful convictions, which makes sense because that was the time period in which incarceration rates in general skyrocketed across the nation. We became the tough on crime, three strikes are out, CSI effect country, and the more arrests there were, well, the more wrongful arrests there were going to be. That's why many of the exonerations we're seeing today are of convictions from that time period. And Philadelphia in particular has a history that compounded these issues. From record levels of mass incarceration to police violence to stop and frisk, prison overcrowding, and even asset forfeiture, a perfect storm of criminal injustice policies has existed in the city for decades. A legacy, many argue, of the notorious police officer, then commissioner, then mayor, named Frank Rizzo. Known as the General, he cut an intimidating figure at a bulky, thick 6'2" man. The ultimate tough guy, he rose in ranks through Philly offices, riding waves of white fear about black crime. During his time as commissioner, he raided Black Panther offices and repeatedly raided protests by black student activists with fully and heavily armed units. Officers, he allegedly told, as they dispersed among student protesters to get their black asses. Under his command, the hiring of black cops plummeted from over 25% recruitment to under 8%. He advocated for the building of more prisons and proudly militarized his police force. The resulting police brutality didn't go unnoticed by the feds. In 1979, 8 years after Rizzo became mayor, the Department of Justice brought charges against Rizzo and others for allowing and indeed fostering police abuse. In his career, he faced dozens of lawsuits, often connected to racial discrimination, and decades after his death, the city still hasn't rolled back the damage. In a 2015 Vice article on Rizzo, criminal defense and civil rights attorney Larry Krasner said, quote, "Rizzo kidnapped the fucking city. That's what he really did. He said, we're cops and we're in charge of the money, the pensions, race relations, and he took us to the bottom of the fucking ocean. He was a strong man who dispenses with niceties like laws and constitutional protections and just gets the job done. And we still have a police department that feels they can do pretty much whatever they want. And they're right about that." Larry Krasner knows something about police misconduct. In his career, he's sued the Philly Police Department 75 times. And this past June, he defeated six opponents in the Democratic primary for the election of the new Philadelphia District Attorney. On November 7th, in just a few weeks, he stands a chance at becoming the new DA of the city. In a New York Times profile, Krasner is described as campaigning against mass incarceration and what he described as the failed culture of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. And so, I figured it was kind of important to talk to him.
Let's not kid ourselves. You're not sleeping in, I'm not sleeping in. There's far too much to do. You need to make your sleep count. So you need Boll & Branch sheets. You'll be so comfortable you'll fall asleep faster, sleep deeper, and wake up ready to kick ass and take names. What makes Boll & Branch sheets unique is that each sheet is crafted from 100% organic cotton. That means Boll & Branch sheets not only feel incredible, but they also look amazing. And since Boll & Branch sells exclusively online, you don't pay that expensive retail markup. That's half the price for twice the quality. You'll love these sheets. Try them for 30 nights and see for yourself. If you're not impressed, you can return them for a full refund. Anyone who sleeps on Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. The New York Times, Forbes, and the Wall Street Journal all rave about them, and even three U.S. presidents have Boll & Branch sheets. So go to BollandBranch.com today, and you'll get $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free shipping in the U.S. when you use the promo code UNDISCLOSED. That's $50 off, plus free U.S. shipping right now at BollandBranch.com. Spelled B-O-L-L and Branch.com, promo code UNDISCLOSED. BollandBranch.com, promo code UNDISCLOSED.
Krasner graduated from Stanford Law School in 1987, where, as a student, he worked closely with indigenous, homeless, and impoverished communities on civil rights and criminal matters. After graduating from such a prestigious institution, he got the kind of job offers you'd expect, prominent positions across the country, including in DA offices.
The truth is, I came out of law school and I applied both to prosecutor's offices and public defender's offices, and I came from a pretty fancy law school, and I had a ton of offers all over the country. Philly was a place where I couldn't be a prosecutor because Philly was drunk on the death penalty and, frankly, drunk on another whole pack of problems that persist in that office and flow from the Frank Rizzo era. And so it was not a place where I could have been a DA. I could have been a DA with Liz Holtzman in Brooklyn if I matched the time and the location. And there were other DA's offices in the country where I could have done it that were more progressive and more ethical than this one. But I chose to become a public defender in Philly, not because I was somehow born with a defense lawyer gene, but because that is where I could fit. And that's where the work really needed to be done, because the system was so unfair, due in large part to the culture of the DA's office.
Now, Krasner may argue he wasn't born with a defense lawyer gene, but given his long history fighting for the underdog against the government, that's a bit hard to buy. But he's right about being drunk on the death penalty. Between the years of 1985 and 1995, the number of death sentences in the state spiked. And while it has steadily decreased since then, the death penalty still does exist in Pennsylvania, although since 2015 there has been a moratorium on carrying out any executions pending the completion of a long-awaited report on the impacts of the death penalty in the state. Krasner served as a public defender for 6 years before starting his own practice in 1993. And since then, he's tried not hundreds but thousands of cases in both state and federal court, meaning he's had a lot of experience with and knows well the history of the very office he's now running for, Philadelphia DA.
You know, this is a city where a police officer rose to be police commissioner, rose to be the mayor, and that was Frank Rizzo. He had a kind of a brutal and a racist approach to all of that, and his long shadow is still here. In fact, his statue is right across from City Hall. and he's the only modern mayor whose statue is across from City Hall. And there are a lot of things that he did that frankly put us in a position where the less progressive, the less racist elements in law enforcement were beat down, and the leadership in law enforcement was more like him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that carried over into the DA's office, which in some ways was really not leading the charge. They were running behind the police department because that's just the culture.
There is a long list of things that DAs shouldn't be doing, and one of them is feeding the mass incarceration beast by prosecuting ridiculously high proportions of arrests made by the police. In Philadelphia, that rate is 97%.
The reality is that the Philadelphia DA's office has been transfixed by almost a stat-driven approach of trying to charge as many people as possible with the biggest charges possible, get the biggest convictions possible for the longest sentences possible. That has been their modus operandi. I have referred to it at various times as kind of a sports mentality where, you know, you're trying to run up the score as high as possible, and that's clearly not what they should be doing.
The task ahead, if elected, is no small one for Krasner. Among the many issues he's got his eye on is the one we spend our time here at Undisclosed on, wrongful convictions. And in Philadelphia, sometimes those wrongful convictions happen unintentionally. And sometimes they're intentional. And sometimes they get covered up.
There have been periods of time, and I know this. I'm not talking about what might be, I'm talking about what I know. There have been periods of time when that shredder was running fast and hard over at the homicide division of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. I have heard with my own ears some rather well-known prosecutors, especially from around the early 90s when a lot of these wrongful convictions occurred. I have heard them say things to the effect of, why are you talking about innocence? If they didn't do this, they did something else, and they must be separated from society, which to me demonstrates almost an eagerness to convict people even when there are ample indications of innocence, just because in the opinion of the prosecutor they're bad people, so we might as well get them anyway.
That's pretty reprehensible.
It's pretty reprehensible, and some of those, you know, wrongful convictions were people who had no criminal record whatsoever. So exactly how they determined they were bad people based upon no criminal record whatsoever, I don't know, but I'm sure your listeners can probably figure out where that's coming from.
I want to say I was shocked or surprised to hear both Larry Krasner and Jim Fogorski say the same thing, that they personally experienced both police and prosecutors knowingly ignore evidence of innocence and put people away for crimes they didn't commit. But I'm not surprised anymore by this level of misconduct. Everyone agrees that most police officers and prosecutors are law-abiding, ethical public servants doing their best to serve the interests of justice. But it's not unusual, when you dig a little deeper into a wrongful conviction, to find some level of misconduct on the part of authorities. That stands true for Sean Thomas as well. By the time Sean's case got to the Innocence Project, it already had a terrible failed procedural history, but not for lack of trying on Sean's part. His first appeal was denied because his lawyer failed to file a brief in support of it. So he filed a pro se motion, a motion without an attorney, to reopen it based on prejudicial and untruthful statements by the prosecutor at trial, but in 1997, the appeal was denied. In 1998, Sean filed his own PCR, or post-conviction relief petition, alleging ineffective assistance of counsel because his trial attorney had failed to duly investigate whether he was at the Youth Study Center during the time of the murder. Indeed, his attorney had not even bothered to try and interview the actual intake officer, Doris Williams, and also failed to call his mother and sister who had been with him at the Youth Study Center that day. Sean also challenged the constitutionality of his life sentence. Before there was a decision in that petition, Sean was appointed a new attorney who filed an amended petition alleging something extraordinary. That evidence which wasn't available at the trial had come to light. John Stallworth, one of the state's witnesses, had told other inmates, and word had gotten back to Sean, that he had lied in his confession. Now, they didn't have any documentation to offer to the court to prove that John said this, and so, as expected, it didn't fly. The court did not find ineffective assistance of counsel, and determined the information about John to be hearsay, so that petition was denied. And a year later, the Superior Court affirmed the denial. In 2004, Sean tried again. He filed a pro se petition for extraordinary relief with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, seeking writ of mandamus, ordering the Philadelphia Family Court to deliver juvenile records. A writ of mandamus, or mandamus as some call it, is an order from a court to an inferior government official, ordering the government official to properly fulfill their duties, or correct an abuse of discretion. In other words, it's an order of the court telling a government official to do something. Sean was asking the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to order the family court to turn over his own juvenile records. And guess what? The petition was denied. Without even a hearing, the court dismissed his petition, finding no legal duty for the family court to give Sean his own records. Remember what I said about the ridiculously tough discovery and public information rules in Pennsylvania? Yeah. This all brings us to 2009, when the Innocence Project took on Sean's case. At this point, he had already been fighting in the appellate courts for over a decade. When the Innocence Project got Sean's case, they knew one thing, that he had been at the Youth Study Center at the time Martinez was killed. Jim Fregorski knew exactly how arrest, detention, and intake worked for juveniles, and everything Sean told him sounded right. And most importantly, he believed him. Based on that belief, the Innocence Project started digging, searching for witnesses and evidence that could get Sean back in court with a new appellate claim or help prove Sean's actual innocence. Jim started by finding the people Sean's trial attorney should have put on the stand, the ones who could prove Sean was at the Youth Study Center on the morning of November 13, 1990. He began with Doris Williams, the woman who had done the intake interview. And as we discussed in a previous episode, Williams confirmed that while she couldn't remember Sean specifically after all these years, there is no way he would have been late without her either delaying his intake until the next day or issuing a bench warrant for his arrest. The fact that he had a signed subpoena from that day proves he was on time. She also confirmed that there was a stenographer present during the intake, just like Sean had been saying all along, which means that entire intake interview was transcribed. If Doris Williams had testified to these things at trial, maybe things would have been different. And she could have if she had been contacted at all. Speaking to Jim was the first time she ever heard of the murder or of Sean's trial. No one had ever gotten in touch with her before. Not Sean's defense counsel from trial, and no one from the state. Next, Jim got in touch with someone who actually had testified at the trial, Brian Cohen. Cohen, who was now in a nursing home in 2011 when Jim contacted him, had no recollection of the case at all, or even of testifying at the trial. But what he could tell Jim was this. If Sean had been late that day, his intake would have been rescheduled. That he was certain of. And if it had been rescheduled, well, that would be easy to find out because it would be recorded in his juvenile file. Except the problem was, Jim explained, no one had the J file. Despite trying every avenue, the Innocence Project was told that it had disappeared. No one could find it. Cohen was surprised he had never before heard of a J file going missing. Maybe he suggested the DA had subpoenaed it, and Jim should check with them. Well, Jim did, and they didn't have it either. The J file would have had a lot of information, as retired Philadelphia police officer Charles McCloskey confirmed to Jim in an affidavit. McCloskey, whose job included overseeing the detention and processing of juveniles, explained how Sean would have been processed given the late time of his arrest the night before. In his affidavit, he said that when an investigator arrived at the detaining district, he or she would usually attempt to interview the offender. The investigator then had to prepare a complaint fact sheet, which was faxed to the district attorney's juvenile charging unit. This document consisted of a narrative provided by the arresting officers of the facts leading up to the offender's arrest, and was also based on an interview with the complainant. The investigator was also required to prepare an arrest report, a juvenile release form, and an investigation report. In 1990, all of these forms were prepared using manual typewriters. The investigation report is a lengthy document with multiple sections, very little of which was pre-formatted, and most of the document required narrative writing, again using a manual typewriter. Then all of this paperwork was required to be completed while the juvenile was still in police custody, because the investigator needed to send all the paperwork via facsimile, yep, a fax machine, to the duty intake officer at the Youth Study Center. and then the investigator would have to await a decision determining if the offender would be released or transported to the Youth Study Center for immediate detention. According to McCloskey, by the time it was all over, it would have been close to dawn, which is exactly, again, what Sean had been saying all along, that around dawn, his mother came and picked him up. And all of those documents he mentioned, those would be all in the J file. They would have been timestamped by the fax machine. But too bad that nobody could find that file. And that wasn't the only thing missing. No one, it seemed, could find the police homicide file either. It wasn't with the police, it wasn't with the DA, it wasn't anywhere. So Jim kept digging. He called up Ron Smith, the witness who was in the car right behind the car that sidelined Martinez. In 2011, when he spoke to Jim, he couldn't recall the color of the car after all these years, but he did seem to recall more details than were in his 1990 statement to the police. He confirmed being directly behind the perp's car, seeing it hit Martinez, saw one man in a long red winter jacket get out of that car, shoot Martinez, and pull him out of his vehicle. When Smith realized what was going on, he slouched down in his seat and drove quickly off. He told Jim the police eventually told him he wasn't needed, which surprised him given him being the closest witness to the murder. But going forward, he'd be available to help Jim out. Now, while Jim was interviewing old witnesses and investigating new leads in the spring and summer of 2011, in the background, Sean had yet another pro se post-conviction relief petition pending from the previous year that again challenged the constitutionality of his life sentence as a juvenile offender. But thanks to his ongoing investigation and what it would yield, Jim would have to twice amend the pending petition in August and November of 2011 because of shocking new evidence that made Sean's innocence clear.
Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your individual needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. Now, we recently set our 2018 schedule for Undisclosed. It's a bunch of new cases in new states, and Stamps.com has made it so easy to get and receive information in all of those cases. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale, without long-term commitments. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again.
In June of 2011, a new piece of evidence was turned over to Jim by the state, a criminalistics laboratory report that had been withheld from the defense all of this time.
I saw that the police had sent evidence to the lab, but there was no scientific report. So I called people in the police department and asked them if they could find out if any lab tests had ever been done on the evidence in the Martinez murder. And about a month later, they got back to me and they sent me, actually I have it here, they sent me the criminalistics report. And it's dated December 16th, 1994, during Sean Thomas's trial. And apparently what happened was, during trial, someone at the criminalistics laboratory named Ronald McCoy had done a comparison between the evidence that was submitted by the police to what was found at the crime scene. And the blue car that had been introduced on the first day of trial as the murder car did not match the evidence at the scene of the crime. So, as a result, on the last day of trial, police introduced two other photos of another blue car. And it was never explained, other than the fact that this was a mistake, why the blue car that had been photographed 2 or 3 years before and was offered up to the court as the murder car on day one, was actually withdrawn without, quietly withdrawn. He never said anything, and another car was introduced.
Because you didn't see this until 2011.
Did not see it. Did not. We saw in the transcript that something strange had happened, but we couldn't understand what it was. There seemed to be two different cars until we saw this and went, oh, well, the first car failed scientific comparison during trial.
Remember last week when we talked about the trial, on the very first day, the prosecutor had introduced 14 photographs of a car. And then, mysteriously, those 14 photographs disappeared. No one ever mentioned them again. That's because the state learned during the trial and never bothered to tell the defense that car didn't match the samples from the crime scene at all. So two photos of a different car ended up being introduced at the end of the trial. A car that the detective didn't know who it belonged to, and one of the stalwarts testified had been towed away long ago. A car that no one could locate and conveniently couldn't be tested. Now you may be thinking, what difference does it make? Whether it was this car or that car doesn't prove any more or less that Sean was in one of those cars. But here's the thing. In the hands of a capable attorney, this kind of evidence could have destroyed the credibility of the only real evidence the state had, the Stallworth brothers. As the Innocence Project so deftly laid out for the court in one of their briefs, had this report been turned over earlier, both brothers could have been cross-examined about the first set of photos. If they confirmed that these were indeed pictures of the car used in the crime, bam, introduce the criminalistic report to show that there was no way it could have been the car. Catching them in a lie right in front of the jury, well, that could have destroyed their credibility, and it could have been exculpatory. And we all know what withholding exculpatory information means. It's a Brady violation. I'm going to stress again that this evidence was withheld from Sean's defense from 1994, the time of the trial, to 2011, 17 years. But remember what I said about how notoriously hard it is to have access to criminal records in Pennsylvania? Here's why.
You can go across the river to New Jersey and do a Freedom of Information Act request. I think they call it New Jersey. We call it Right to Know Law in Pennsylvania. And in New Jersey, you can get anything regarding a criminal investigation. You get the entire homicide file, the entire police file. Pennsylvania, we have a Right to Know Law, which supposedly holds public agencies accountable and gives us their information. But anything to do with a, quote, criminal investigation is exempt from that. It doesn't mean it's confidential and it can't be turned over. It's always within the discretion of the agency to turn it over or not, but they can always hide behind the Right to Know Law.
Right, and they do.
And they do.
If you see in like many cases, like if you to make it more common, that something happens, you see automatically on the news or on YouTube dash cam footage. Mm-hmm. You don't see that here in Pennsylvania because that footage does not have to be turned over. It's part of the criminal investigation. So, and I get envious when I'm seeing what happened, within hours of something happening or days of something happening, you're seeing the dash cam video, you're seeing actual proof of what happened.
That's Attorney Riley Ross, who is not only on the board of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, he's an experienced criminal defense and civil rights lawyer in the state. I admit, I was frankly shocked to learn about the fact that a defendant doesn't have an actual right to records related to the very criminal investigation that put him behind bars, not even in the years after the case is closed. And I was shocked because that's not true in most states. And this is a huge problem for defendants and attorneys in Pennsylvania.
Some of the difficulties are just with regards to a lack of open discovery. I mean, I think that's what it comes down to. You don't really know what you're getting because no one's there to tell the government, hey, turn over everything. You have the government in state and federal cases that the prosecutor makes the decisions on what's Brady. Brady meaning if there's anything that's helpful to the defense, you have to turn it over. And they have the right to consider it. And that could be helpful in the sense of, they have a witness saying that if my client is John, that witness saying that Joe did it. Obviously, that's pretty obvious that I should know that someone else is saying someone other than my client did it. But if there is evidence that, let's say, Susan is the witness against my client, and Susan's saying my client did it, yet she's going around telling other people that, you know what, I got something in for John, and I don't really like John, I'm entitled to know that as well, because I'm entitled to know information that may be biased, and that may not be so clear-cut. So when you have a prosecutor that can make the decision, the determination, by looking at all of his or her files and say, I don't think this is really Brady. I don't think this really has anything to do with the case. that makes it problematic because they're the ones making that determination. And obviously, if they're the ones bringing the charges, they could be a little biased. And so the lack of...
So what does open discovery look like? What does that, can you explain what that would look like if you had that here?
In its pure sense, that means, here's my file, come and take a look at it, make copies of whatever you want, or, hey, I'm going to copy the whole file and send it over to you, mm-hmm. without going through and picking through. And that file meaning what the prosecutor has gotten from his or her investigators, what they've been able to compile, what they've used in order to charge my client. So everything that they're going to be using to that they've used so far to bring the charges against him, against my client, is going to be, I'm going to have access to. And that's open discovery in its pure sense, which if you think that's how, you know, the goal here is justice and making sure justice is served, then everything that you have access to, let me have access to.
Adding to the problem of relying on prosecutors to decide what's helpful to your client or not, even when the prosecutors are acting in good faith, is this.
In Pennsylvania, in particular in the state system, it's very different from the way the federal system is run on discovery, because in the federal system, the prosecutors are very often involved in the investigation from the very get-go, like from the time that a search warrant is done, or they're even just gathering information against a particular defendant. In the state system, the police do all of that. And then only after they've issued an arrest warrant or made an arrest, then they hand over what they think they need to, under Brady, to the prosecutor. So it's this very bizarre game of go fish. Mm-hmm. Right? So the prosecutor says to the police, do you have any witness statements? Yeah, I got one of those. Mm-hmm. Right? And so they choose what they think is relevant and necessary
to the
prosecutors.
So the police files are not even turned over to the prosecutor?
No. They don't get it. They don't get it. In any jurisdiction we've ever been in, I've never seen that. I am confident that the police file becomes the prosecutor's file, then the prosecutor's file goes to defense. It is a winnowing of information mm-hmm. from the investigation to defense counsel.
The criminalistics report gave Jim another issue to raise for the PCR, and he amended the petition to reflect this new evidence. But not long after, he found himself having to amend the petition once again. That's because Mustafa, Sean's brother, had provided them with some documents from his trial attorney's file. Remember, he had been tried with Sean, but he was represented by a different lawyer. These documents were handwritten statements by Nathaniel Stallworth, the self-admitted alcoholic, heroin, and cocaine addict who had led the police to his cousins, John and William. The letters were written in 1994, before Mustafa and Sean actually went to trial. And here is what Nathaniel had to say. I'm writing on behalf of Mustafa and Sean Thomas. I lied about everything I said about Mustafa and Sean only because the detective said that they did it, that Mustafa had shot a man. The detective tried to say that I did it, so I got scared and started to say anything. I was under duress. I did not want to go to jail again. I am very sorry that I lied. I wish I could tell Mustafa that I am sorry for lying on him. At night, I can't sleep knowing that I got a man in jail for nothing at all. If possible, I would like to testify on behalf of Mustafa to declare the allegations I've made. Thank you, Nathaniel. But Nathaniel never testified. The state never called him. And for some reason, neither did Mustafa's attorney. So his recantation never made it into court. Not through his personal testimony and not through those letters, which couldn't be introduced into evidence without him. These letters weren't the only other reason the PCR petition had to be amended. Jim sent a letter to William Stallworth, the brother who originally told the police he had no idea what this crime was about. And William wrote him back. And in that letter, he said that Sean Thomas had nothing to do with the crime and that he was willing to meet and discuss it. So Marissa went with an investigator to meet William, who had been released after serving time for the Martinez murder, but ended up violating his probation and was back in prison.
Actually, Marissa Bluestein went to see him with an investigator. And what she expected to hear, I don't want to say it for her, but I think what she expected to hear was, because of what he had said in his letter, that Sean Thomas was wrongly convicted, that he was going to say, look, I was there. They made me say Sean was there, but he wasn't. But what he actually said was, I don't know what happened because I wasn't there. And it sort of stunned everybody who heard it, myself, that later that day, because then we didn't know what we had. I mean, how is it possible that none of these people did this murder? And he said, I don't know. I mean, I said what I said to save my brother and to make a deal for myself, but I don't know who did this murder. And he said, I don't know if Sean did it because I wasn't there. And that was the only person who said that Sean Thomas was at the scene of the murder. He later also recanted to the parole board and was held in prison for an additional 4 years or 3 years after that as a result, because he wouldn't, he said he would no longer take responsibility.
According to William, he said that after he provided the police with his first statement in which he denied any involvement, he was taken into a room at the Philadelphia Police Homicide Division with his cousin, Nathaniel Stallworth, and his brother, John Stallworth, who had already confessed to the murder and agreed to testify against others. Homicide investigators showed William a copy of John Stallworth's statement and told William that he had to tell the same story that his brother John was telling in order for John to get the deal that they agreed to. A few months after getting William Stallworth's recantation, Jim was able to secure the statements of two handwriting experts who compared Sean's signature to the signature on the subpoena he had signed the morning of the murder, something that could have certainly been done at the time of the trial, and something the jury actually requested, but it was never done. All of this new evidence went into an amended PCRA petition filed by Jim with the Pennsylvania Court of Common Pleas in an attempt to get Sean's conviction overturned. Now you'd think, given the clear recantations by Nathaniel and William, coupled with nearly irrefutable evidence that Sean had been at the Youth Study Center at the time of the murder, his appeal would be a slam dunk. But on June 13, 2014, the court found that some of the issues raised by Sean had no merit and others were untimely, and his petition for post-conviction relief was dismissed. When I first encountered this case last year at that event in Philadelphia with Marissa, there was an ongoing appeal for Sean in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. It was the appeal of the dismissal of his PCRA. Sometime last year, late in the fall, after being briefed on the facts, the undisclosed team decided that we would investigate and report on Sean's case the following year, meaning this year, and we'd let the Pennsylvania Innocence Project know, so they could start to share the case files with us, and we could get started. Not long after that, though, there was a new development in the Philadelphia criminal justice scene, a major upgrade to the city's three-year-old conviction review unit, which had been established by former DA Seth Williams. The purpose of the Conviction Review Unit, or the CRU, was to take a look at cases where actual innocence was being claimed outside of the court system. It didn't start off so great, though.
Well, it's an interesting history with that. So it was, Seth originally put it up, I think, in 2015 or 2014, and he assigned one district attorney to do it, who had been a homicide prosecutor for about 20 years. It was kind of shocking to me when sitting down with Mark, and he would sit down with me anytime I asked. You know, there was absolutely open about that. But I would ask him, well, what are your protocols? What are you, how are you going to proceed? And he didn't have any. He wasn't given any marching orders, any directives. So we would try to kind of develop more of a working relationship with that. Within about 6 weeks of him being appointed to the Conviction Review Unit, Seth also appointed him to run the investigations against a group of state legislators in Harrisburg who were accused of graft, essentially. So you went from one full-time to one part-time. And at the time, when people asked me about that, I said, you know, it's like Vice President Biden says, right? Don't tell me your values. Show me your budget, and I'll tell you your values, right? So to me, the fact that they were willing to have the unit showed me that what level of priority that current administration had into truly delving into these cases. So Mark really was pulled in two different directions. Once Kathy Martin came on staff as Seth's, I think, was integrity officer, chief of staff.
I think, yeah.
She helped to integrate a new era of the conviction unit, and she and I started meeting. I think she said on the record, kind of in secret, that's only half joking, to try to talk about how would this unit be restructured? What kind of protocols would they have? What would be the way that they would flow cases? What's the standard of proof that they would need? I mean, a critical, critical question. How would what level of convincing would we have to do with them to be able to reverse a conviction? What could they do? And over several months of working with Kathy, and Kathy reached out to John Hallway at the Quatrain Center for the Fair Administration of Justice, we put together protocols for the unit. And then they hired two full-time prosecutors. They hired an outside investigator. They hired a paralegal. Well, they rerouted the two DAs and the paralegal, but they hired an investigator into the unit. And they started in January. And we sat down with them in January. And we presented several cases, Sean Thomas being one.
By January, Marissa means this past January, 2017. They presented Sean's case to the CRU and also gave them a heads up that the case would be covered this year but undisclosed. Now, I'm not saying our potential investigation and reporting had any impact on the decisions made by the CRU, but I'm also not saying it definitely didn't. After reviewing Sean's case and realizing his attorney still had been unable to get his juvenile and homicide file for all these years, the folks at the CRU did everything they could to remedy that.
They took an objective view, and they looked at the case. You know, ironically, even though the Commonwealth is his alibi witness, there was no records that we could get to verify that, to show that. And they tried. And they looked at it. They pulled their file. They were able to get the homicide file. They interviewed witnesses. They talked with us about the case. They tried to keep us updated on the progress.
One of those updates came in April of this year, just a few months after the CRU began investigating the case.
The first thing that happened was in April, they called us, you know, myself and Marissa Bluestein, and told us that they had finished their investigation into Sean's alibi, and they, the team's consensus was that they believed that Sean was most likely, or you know, more likely than not, at the Youth Study Center the morning of the murder. And I thought, well, that means he's innocent. And then they also said that William Stallworth had recanted his testimony to them as well.
And then on May 12th, 2017, this.
And then one day, Andrew Welbrock, who's the assistant director of the unit, he and I were doing a presentation down at the Bar Association. And I came in to see him. He says, "You're going to want to read this." And he handed me a letter. And it was a letter from Kathy Martin, who is the, I guess at that point, the acting district attorney. And it said, "We have received information from the homicide file, which we believe should have been turned over 22 years ago. On the strength of that, we agreed to vacate his conviction."
I got a text from Marissa not long after telling me the DA had agreed to throw out Sean's conviction. Now, I can be a bit of a blubbery fool, so I cried happy tears along with her, even as she joked about how Undisclosed was not going to have a case to do anymore. Which, by the way, was fine with all of us.
Just, it was such an emotional release, because we've been fighting so hard for and having nobody listen and at all. Give any kind of objective view, not the DA's, not the courts, not the Superior Court, as far as we knew. And so to see those words was cathartic.
Jim, having developed a deep friendship with Sean over these many years, had the honor of telling him that he was going to be a free man.
Well, I called him up and I read the letter, because we had gotten a letter from the DA's office, and it said that as a result of our investigation that we've completed, we no longer have confidence in the verdict, and we're going to vacate this conviction. So I called him up and I told him, and I said, "Sean, I read it to him," and he didn't say anything. And I said, "Sean, this means you're getting out. Yeah, we're going to let you go." And he said, "I'm getting out." I said, "Yeah," and he laughed. He laughed, and I said, "No, this is serious." And he said, "Really, I'm getting out." And I said, "Yeah." And it was May. It was, I think, it was like 3 days before Mother's Day. So he said, "Don't tell my mom." And he said, "I want to tell her myself. I'm going to bring her up here on Mother's Day."
It was a terrible, long, hard road for Sean. 24 years. He was convicted at the age of 19, and today he's 42 years old.
Our whole way, it's just been a struggle, right? We find evidence, they hide it, we got to play hide and seek. You know, I've been doing this for 24 years, so I said, "Jim, I believe when I walk out, like, I said, I don't trust these people." He's like, "Well, it's going to happen, Sean." I said, "Well, as long as you be at the door waiting for me, I believe when I'm at the door, and I'm going out, you know, be waited." I mean, I think we went upstairs, we had to wait. You know, it was a waiting process. I still was calm, though. I wasn't, like, a lot of stuff was going through my mind. they made me pack up my stuff. I was like, I'm really going home. I said, okay. Boy, boy, boy. I mean, it's a lot, you know, because I was real thankful. You know, that's one thing I really thrive on, you know, being Muslim is humbleness. And I'm real thankful, you know, after 25 years, you know, Allah blessed me with help with Jim, the Innocent Project.
But the struggle was over. And perhaps the sweetest moment of it all came when he got to tell his mother.
She just came. I said, yo, I need to see you for Mother's Day. She's like, that'd be nice. I'll be, I told my sister I need to see her. We never told her what was it about or nothing. So as we was in to go visit, I said, Mom, let me ask you a question. When you gonna stop smoking? She said, well, when you come home, when I stop smoking. I just was laughing. I said, you sure you gonna stop? She said, yeah, when you come home, I'm gonna stop smoking. I said, well, babe, got about a week to stop smoking. She looked at me. She said, stop playing with me. But she's real funny. She's laughing. She looked at me and my sister. I'm like, oh, it's getting ready to happen. She just got quiet for a minute. She looked at my sister like, stop playing with me. My sister like, no, the joke's on you. And I told her, she said, Jim ain't called me. I said, he wasn't going to call you until after I talked to you. Then, after I told her, she still was like, stuck. I just grabbed and hugged her. I was like, everything going to be all right, babe.
9 days after Mother's Day, Sean walked out a free man. We at Undisclosed did debate whether or not to still cover Sean's case. After all, his conviction had been thrown out, but the story itself deserved telling. But at Undisclosed, one of the most important factors we consider in covering cases is this: can it help free an innocent person? Sean is now free, completely so. In June, the district attorney announced that it was completely dropping all charges and that he would not be retried for this murder. But remember, there was a murder. And that homicide file that showed up this spring, after more than two decades of being lost, had some very important information. Information about who might have killed Domingo Martinez.
The underlying thing that always astonishes me when we're facing prosecutors who don't want to look at this, especially when there's DNA, if my guy didn't do it, the person who did do it is still out there.
Next time on Undisclosed. A very big thank you to everyone who has made this show and this series possible, starting with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Thank you guys for everything you do and for working with us on this case. Thank you to our amazing producer, Mithil Thelhan, for keeping it all together. Thank you to Baluki for our original and this new logo. Thanks to our fantastic sponsors who make it possible for us to come back week after week with new episodes for you guys. Thanks to all of you listeners for your continued support. Lots of gratitude to audio producer extraordinaire Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and also the host of the fantastic podcast Crime Writers On. Please do follow us on social media. You'll find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. The handle is @UndisclosedPod. And don't forget to tweet your questions at us. Every week, John Cryer will be back to host our addendum. Very excited about that. Thank you to John for doing that again for us. But make sure you use the hashtag UDAddendum so we can find your questions. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Undisclosed.